This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we've ended the year on a pretty astounding note. Nearly 200 nations have finally signed onto an agreement to combat climate change.
And the UN's Climate Change Conference in Paris yielded a historic agreement to contain CO2 emissions. Emerging nations such as India and China, big contributors to the greenhouse gas problem, also agreed to the accord. And as they're discovering in China, with the devastating air quality issues that they're having there, greenhouse gas emissions are a real threat to human health.
They absolutely are. And the World Health Organization has deemed climate change and global warming as the biggest threats to the human health in the 21st century, from infectious diseases such as malaria, dengue, and cholera, as well as treating people that are affected by cancer, respiratory, cardiovascular, and other diseases caused by environmental problems.
And the World Health Organization's director has urged the world's healthcare providers to become champions of efforts to limit the hazards to health that are wrought by CO2 emissions and the globe's warming temperatures.
Now, on to other health issues that had a devastating effect on global health, the AIDS epidemic, which has caused the death of 23 million people around the world.
And our guest today is on the front lines of seeking a cure for this deadly pandemic. Kevin Robert Frost is the CEO of AMFAR, one of the first nonprofit organizations formed over 30 years ago to confront the AIDS epidemic by sponsoring research to find a cure. Much of their initial work has led to the treatment and prevention strategies that we see today having such a positive impact, and their important work continues. We look forward to hearing all about that from him.
Lori Robertson also stops by. The managing editor of factcheck.org is always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policies in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love to hear from you. We'll get to our interview with Kevin Robert Frost in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The good news is there's a cure. The not so good news, the cost. The drug that successfully cures hepatitis C is starting to have an impact, not only on the health of those suffering from the liver killing virus, but it's also taking a toll on state Medicaid budgets. In 2014, 33 states spent a combined $1 billion treating Hep C patients with Sovaldi, Gilead Services' Hep C curing drug that runs, on average, $84,000 to treat one patient at a pill a day for several months. Sounds like a lot of money, but that was spent in less than 3% of the Medicaid patients in need of the drug. An estimated 2.7 million Americans are living with chronic hepatitis C infection, and those on Medicaid are told they have to wait until they're sicker. Florida may not have expanded Medicaid, but the state is taking up a subject of medical marijuana. Language has been finalized in the bill that would allow prescriptions for medical marijuana for patients suffering from a number of debilitating diseases. 23 states in the District of Columbia, meanwhile, allow marijuana use for those suffering from a range of ailments, from HIV, glaucoma, cancer, and epilepsy. Melanoma, it's on the rise. The FDA is considering a ban on minors using tanning beds in an effort to cut down on the rise of skin cancer in young people. The CDC's Tom Frieden continues to urge Americans to get the flu shot this year, warning that window is narrowing before flu season kicks into high gear. Meanwhile, Google has made inroads in the business of tracking the flu epidemic, which is off to a slow start thanks to the unusually warm weather. Google's flu trends have provided public health officials with real-time tracking analytics on flu outbreaks throughout the country. Now it's turning its sights on sexually transmitted diseases, which are on the rise in this country and elsewhere. Public health researchers say tracking for prevalence of searches for things like painful urination could target their efforts to do more outreach in areas with higher queries on the Google search engine. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're We're speaking today with Kevin Robert Frost, Chief Executive Officer of AMFAR, the Foundation for AIDS Research, a 30-year-old organization dedicated to advancing the science that will end the HIV/AIDS pandemic. Mr. Frost has served on President Obama's Advisory Committee on HIV/AIDS, and as Vice President of Global Initiatives, he also served on the Advisory Committee for the 14th and 16th Annual AIDS Conference in Barcelona and Toronto, and has worked as an inpatient coordinator for the AIDS program at New York City's Bellevue Hospital. Mr. Frost has advised the FDA on breakthrough AIDS drug development. Kevin, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks for having me.
So AMFAR was formed 3 decades ago as one of the first not-for-profit research organizations dedicated to seeking a cure for AIDS. And when you joined in 1994, an HIV or AIDS diagnosis was synonymous to a death sentence in most cases. Could you talk to our listeners about the early days of AMFAR and how your community of experts helped turn the tide in treating the AIDS epidemic?
Before I came to AMFAR, immediately before I came to AMFAR, I was working at NYU Bellevue Hospital here in New York City, and I was working on a research protocol for a infection that a lot of people with AIDS got, which was called CMV, and it was an infection in the eye that would lead to blindness. And they were mostly men in those days. When they would come to our clinic to be enrolled in these research protocols, their average life expectancy was 9 months. We're living in a whole new world today in which people with an HIV diagnosis, if they are fortunate enough to live in a country where they have access to treatment and they have access to a doctor and healthcare, can expect to live a normal, healthy life well into their 70s, which is not to say that it's still not complicated. You are dealing with a chronic illness. But we've just made enormous progress as a result of having changed the research paradigm in this country and having changed the drug approval process, which led us to the point where we were able to make enormous strides. A 30-year-old epidemic sounds like a long time, but the amount of progress that we've made in fighting this disease and understanding this disease has been nothing short of astonishing.
When you look at the list of achievements that have been accrued by AMFAR, your early work led to the development of protease inhibitors. And maybe share with us, what was remarkable about those early days of AIDS research, given how little we actually knew? And how did some of those early discoveries really shape the treatment protocols that are so commonplace today?
25 and 30 years ago, there wasn't a lot of money being spent in research. And in fact, AMFAR was one of the first organizations to understand, at least on the nonprofit side, that it was only going to be investments in research that would bring us the kind of answers that could make a difference in fighting the epidemic. You know, the NIH and pharmaceutical companies were not investing huge sums, and so we were able to leverage even small amounts of money to achieve important breakthroughs. The philosophical way in which AMFAR has approached its work is very different from the way the NIH and pharmaceutical companies and those with large amounts of money sort of approach their work. We have, from the very beginnings of this organization, viewed ourselves as venture capitalists in research, if you will. We've never had an endowment here because we've always believed that our job as an organization was to put ourselves out of business. So we've made investments with every dollar that we've been able to raise, but we've done it in the highest risk areas, knowing that a lot of those investments would fail, but the ones that would pay off, we hope at least, would have an outsized impact. And I think that's been true in the area of protease, as you've mentioned, but also in the area of CCR5, as you've mentioned, mother-to-child transmission, and other ways that we've had significant impact. It's because we've taken greater risks to get there.
Here in America, AIDS was really very much associated with diseases of the gay population or IV drug users. But in the third world, where there's a much wider pandemic, and AMFAR has been pioneering research on mother-to-infant infection, could you talk about the scope of the mother-to-child transmissions in the global AIDS picture? And how close are we to getting to zero mother-child infections?
Well, although we often in the West think of AIDS in the context, as you said, of a gay disease or even in the context of, you know, injecting drug users, those populations are simply dwarfed by the epidemic among heterosexuals. Globally, this is an epidemic between men and women. And as a result of that, it is an epidemic of transfer from mothers to their newborns. And I think we've made enormous progress. You know, we've essentially all but eliminated infections from mother to newborns here in the West. But we still have a very long way to go in terms of eliminating those infections in the developing world. And the big part of the problem is just simply access mm-hmm. to health care, particularly prenatal care. And so one sort of surrogate marker, if you will, is a very basic question of how well are we getting people onto treatment? Because we know putting people on treatment for HIV disease will prevent transmission from mothers to their newborns. There are nearly 39 million people living with HIV globally, and roughly 15 million of them are on treatment, meaning less than half, 40%. And if you just roughly estimate that half of those are women, you see what kind of a challenge we face. And very often what they have to do with are all of the tangential issues that surround access to health care mm-hmm. and aren't necessarily specific to our understanding of how to prevent transmission from mothers to their newborns.
In addition to spearheading key research on the quest to find a cure for HIV/AIDS, AMFAR played an early role in promoting some of the really important government policies both domestically and globally. There was research going on, but access to trials was actually quite limited. So could you talk with us a little bit about the government policies that were spearheaded by AMFAR, such as the HOPE Act and the Ryan White Care Act, and how did these and other policies help address the gap in research and in access to care?
Well, what the HOPE Act, the early HOPE Act did, and eventually what Ryan White did, is that it provided a framework for the states to take federal money and use that money in service to providing care for people with HIV. And in many states, particularly in the South, the only money that was spent in many of those states on HIV/AIDS was money that came from the federal government. A big part of that, in my view, was related to sort of the stigma mm-hmm. and the populations that were affected here. They tended to be drug users. They tended to be gay men. They tended to be all these populations that a lot of states didn't want to look at or deal with. And I think that what we were able to do here early on in the epidemic was to understand very clearly the political dimensions of HIV disease. And it was really one of the first diseases, I think, that we really had a very big political dimension to. It wasn't just about medicine. It certainly wasn't just about healthcare. And part of the reason for that was the lack of a political attention that the disease received. President Reagan did not publicly speak about HIV, did not publicly right. mention the disease until 40,000 people in this country had already died from it. And you contrast that with something like Legionnaire's disease and how much front page newspaper attention that disease was receiving when only a handful of people, relative handful of people, were afflicted by it. There's no way to explain those differences except to understand that the populations affected were different and were viewed differently by society and certainly by politicians. And I think by understanding those political dimensions, we were able to advocate for policies that ultimately made access to health care, access to treatment, and even by extension, access to research more available to the people who needed it most.
We're speaking today with Kevin Robert Frost, Chief Executive Officer of AMFAR, the Foundation for AIDS Research, a 30-year organization dedicated to advancing the science that will end the HIV/AIDS pandemic. During his tenure at AMFAR, Mr. Frost served on numerous committees, including President Obama's Advisory Committee on HIV/AIDS. You know, I want to talk a little bit about that intersection of the political and the regulatory. You had the opportunity of having Commissioner Hamburg from the FDA on the show recently, and certainly the struggle that they face in terms of the length of time from bench to bedside. At the same time, this enormous problem is arising. I want to have you share with our listeners how you've worked your collaboration with drug makers as well as with the FDA, what the experience has been, and what's the state of that relationship today.
If you roll back the clock 30 years to the early years of the AIDS epidemic, what you found was an agency that was entrenched in its views, and those were largely dinosauric, if you will, about how the drug development process had to happen. And what it wasn't prepared to do was respond quickly to an emerging epidemic the way HIV was. A diagnosis of AIDS was really essentially a death sentence. So activists came together and working with organizations like ours and GMHC and AIDS Project Los Angeles and many others were able to effectively change the paradigm of how drug approvals were done at the FDA and created systems that had never been created before, like parallel access to experimental medicines, such that even before a drug would get approved, community access could be made available to those who didn't qualify for clinical trials. And that has changed the paradigm so effectively. When we first began, almost all drug trials in this country were done in academic settings. There's no AIDS drug that has probably come onto the market in the last decade that hasn't had the vast majority of its broad access research done in doctors' offices, in the very communities where it's needed most. And that has not only sped up the research process itself, but it's provided greater access to people for experimental medicines, the ones who absolutely need it most.
If you had told me a few decades ago that we would now have HIV drug protocols that allow for a normal lifespan in most cases, I would have been stretched to believe that. But what's really remarkable is that global health officials target 2030 as their year for a cure. And you have said that there are some indications that we may be closer than that, which is truly remarkable. Tell us and our listeners about some of the functional cure stories that have garnered recent attention, the so-called Berlin patient or the Visconti cohorts, and what kind of promise do these stories hold for the broader population?
It all begins, in my view at least, with the Berlin patient, because this was really and truly a pivotal moment in the history of AIDS research. The Berlin patient is the story of a young man who was living with HIV for many years and happened to be living in Berlin, who was diagnosed with cancer. And as a result, needed to undergo a bone marrow transplant as part of his treatment. His doctor used a very experimental protocol in which he found a donor who happened to have a mutation in a protein on the surface of CD4 cells called CCR5. And we know that CCR5 is the entryway for HIV and ultimately causes infection. This person underwent this bone marrow transplant, and ultimately he adapted the immune system of the donor and became resistant to HIV infection. And so ultimately he is the only person whom there is broad scientific consensus has been cured of his HIV disease. For the very first time, we had at least proof that someone could be cured. Even if we couldn't replicate it, and we have not been able to replicate it, it showed that someone could be cured of this disease. And what we then moved from was an era of discovery research, because we had spent 25 years in the epidemic trying to understand all of the elements. How do people get infected? What is the infectious agent? We moved out of that era and into an era of technological challenge. Through the Berlin patient, we now understood what the challenges were to curing people, and that completely changed the nature of research. And over the course of the last 7 or 8 years, there has been this tectonic shift in the thinking of scientists around what it would take to cure people. But in addition to that, you have these other stories that you mentioned, like the Visconti cohort in Europe, which is a group of people who have been living for a very long time with HIV, but have essentially intact immune systems that are effectively controlling the infection. And what that has done is provided a different kind of paradigm, which is more akin to sort of our understanding of how to approach cancer, which is to create a remission. Mm-hmm. And so we've largely moved away from the use of the term functional cure, because what we're actually trying to do is create an environment in people wherein their own immune systems, whether stimulated through a vaccine or stimulated through certain treatments, could effectively control HIV infection. So they may be living with HIV, but the HIV isn't causing any disease. It's not infectious to other people, and it's controlled without the use of ongoing treatments or drugs. And so that would be a state of remission, I think, that will really probably be the next step in our journey towards ultimately developing a cure which will rid the body of HIV. Hmm.
Well, Kevin, we're working to contain the spread of virus through targeted prevention measures. And the Western world has done a pretty good job for the most part, but there are pockets of concern. Some 50,000 new infections occur each year in this country. While the many HIV positive people are getting the antiretroviral drugs, millions more have yet to gain access to these life-saving treatments. And new drugs like Truvada, the so-called PrEP approach, are showing great promises in preventing transmission. Can you tell our listeners about prevention methods and what can be done to improve our prevention efforts?
Certainly, any conversation around prevention begins with condoms, because they have been enormously effective in our 30-year battle with this disease. You also have things like syringe exchange, which have driven down the rates of new infections. At least here in the state of New York, they're reporting zero new infections in injecting drug users, largely because of a very long campaign to provide clean syringes for those who are injecting drugs. Circumcision has been proven to reduce the rate of acquisition, and so you have circumcision programs throughout Africa which are highly effective. You have mother-to-child transmission programs which have reduced the rate of transmission from mothers to their newborns. You mentioned PrEP, which is a single daily pill that can prevent the acquisition of HIV, and that's being used a great deal, particularly here in the West, in gay communities. And then you have something that came out of a study just a couple of years ago, which was also, I think, a seminal moment in our history, which is referred to as the HVTN study 052. What the 052 study showed was that when you put people on treatment and they are effectively treated, meaning their viral load levels are driven down so low that they're undetectable, those people have a 0% chance of transmitting the virus to their partners. It is virtually zero chance of transmitting it. So if you add up all of these interventions, we actually have the tools in our grasp today to completely and radically change the trajectory of the epidemic worldwide. We could drive down 50,000 new infections to nearly zero in this country. The reason we haven't been able to do that is because we don't have the political will and the financial investments to back up the scientific achievements. And so until we're prepared to make those investments, we're never going to get to the point where we can end the epidemic through those methodologies alone. That's why we continue to invest in cure research. It's why we need a vaccine if we really want to end the pandemic worldwide.
Well, Kevin, this past year, we watched the world react in alarm and horror when the Ebola epidemic broke out in West Africa. But the global community found a way eventually to contain and stop the epidemic. And from it, we learned so much that hopefully provide a useful blueprint for public health officials the next time such an epidemic occurs. And we have learned so much from the AIDS epidemic and from the history of it over these decades. But maybe you could take a few minutes to comment from your perspective. What are the most valuable lessons and takeaways from battling the AIDS pandemic?
The AIDS epidemic was actually a blueprint for how not to approach an epidemic. The AIDS epidemic was all about governments and those responsible sticking their heads in the sand and not responding in the way that they could have or should have. When those very first infections began to emerge and the CDC began to understand that we were dealing with an infectious agent, we took none of the right steps to address that. And so part of what happened in the context of Ebola was that I think people looked at the AIDS epidemic, those who remember, and said, we can't make these same mistakes again. On top of that, you now had a global, and certainly in the context of Africa, you had an infrastructure, an architecture built, if you will, over the last 20 years or plus to respond to the AIDS epidemic that could be mobilized to respond to the Ebola epidemic. And that included not just HIV/AIDS, but malaria and TB and other disease areas. And I think you had a better sense of responsibility on the part of our global agencies like the World Health Organization to get behind significant and comprehensive efforts to bring the Ebola epidemic under control or face the kind of global pandemic that we continue to face in the AIDS epidemic. And I think a lot of people were determined not to see that happen. And as a result, I think if there are any silver linings at all, it is that it provided us an understanding of how bad it could get with Ebola. And that, I think, ultimately led to the effective response that we've seen.
We've been speaking today with Kevin Robert Frost, CEO of MFAR, the Foundation for AIDS Research, a 30-year organization dedicated to advancing the science that will end the HIV/AIDS pandemic. You can learn more about their work by going to MFAR.org, or you can follow them on Twitter at MFAR. Kevin, thank you so much for the work that you're doing and for joining us today in Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for having me.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Hillary Clinton said at the Democratic presidential debate in November that nearly 3,000 people had been killed by guns, including 200 children, since the Democrats had last debated about a month before. Some of our readers asked us if that was correct. Comprehensive data on that specific time frame isn't available. Instead, Clinton extrapolated the numbers based on figures on gun deaths from past years. In 2013, there were 33,636 gun deaths, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That averages to about 2,800 gun deaths, or nearly 3,000, as Clinton said, each month of the year. These are the most recent numbers from the CDC. They include suicides, which made up 63% of gun deaths that year, homicides, 33% of gun deaths, and unintentional discharges, legal interventions or war, and undetermined causes. As for firearm deaths of children, the Clinton campaign relied on figures from 2010. The 2013 CDC figures for children 19 and younger back her up. Those gun deaths averaged 205 per month. But if we look only at those age 17 and under, the average killed by month was 105. We won't know the number of gun deaths for 2015 for another year or so, and even then, we won't be able to look at the number for a specific time period, as Clinton cited. A group called the Gun Violence Archive seeks to provide near real-time tracking of gun incidents through media, government, and other sources. For 2015, it counts 11,633 gun deaths through November 18. But that number doesn't yet include suicides, which the group says are not reported the same way as other incidents. The group's executive director told us Clinton's 3,000 figure would likely be right, at least based on a monthly average for the year, once suicides are included. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Right now, there are about 3.5 million people living in refugee camps around the world. Whether displaced by wars or natural disasters, the plight of these people is often the same, living in squalid conditions in tent cities that provide little protection from harsh elements. And these conditions pose serious threats to their health and well-being. The IKEA Foundation has taken the parent company's wildly successful do-it-yourself approach to home furnishings and applied it to the problem of inadequate housing for displaced refugees. They've created a do-it-yourself dwelling that can be shipped and assembled anywhere.
So first and foremost, there's the very well-known flat pack approach that IKEA has pioneered. Secondly, the materials and the product itself. So it's a shelter. It's not a tent.
Jonathan Spampinato is the head of communications and strategic planning at the IKEA Foundation. They're working closely with United Nations organizations working on the ground, trying to assist refugees in Somalia and other parts of the world.
We extended that to also include funding for an innovation unit within the UNHCR so they could think more long term. So providing that funding allowed them to start the refugee housing shelter, looking at how to design a better shelter.
And since on average a person is likely to spend up to 12 years in a refugee camp, these IKEA structures have some unique properties that can make the experience more bearable.
The walls and the the roof are made out of a new fancy version of basically a plastic material that is much more durable but very, very lightweight and still is insulated.
The IKEA Foundation currently has prototypes being tested in various refugee camps and will scale up production once refinements are made. And, true to IKEA, the price point is going to come in under $1,000 per structure. A deliverable, affordable, do-it-yourself dwelling that can provide some sense of dignity, privacy, and protection for families who are struggling as refugees. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.